secession from Spain on November 9th. The ruling Basque National Party has said any right of self-determination should be negotiated with the central government. The once popular Spanish King Juan Carlos, who helped smooth Spain's transition to democracy in the 1970s after the Francisco Franco dictatorship, seemed increasingly out of touch in recent years. He took a secret luxury elephant hunting trip to Botswana in 2012 at a time when one in four Spanish workers was jobless and the government teetered on the brink of default. A corruption scandal in the family and his visible infirmity after repeated surgery in recent years have also eroded public support. Polls show greater support in the low-key Felipe, who is 46, who has not been tarnished by the corruption allegations. The king's younger daughter, Princess Cristina, and her husband, Iñaki Urdangarin, are under investigation, and a judge is expected to decide soon whether...
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Saboteur, attention à ton fardeau d'une mute. C'est nous qui frissons le barreau des prisons.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
You know, it's hard to be black in a world controlled by white folks. Du Bois said we always have the double consciousness. We're trying to be black, and meanwhile you got a white ghost hovering over your head that says, if you don't do this, you'll get killed. If you don't do this, you won't get no money. If you don't do this, nobody will think you're beautiful. If you don't do this, nobody will think you're smart. That's the ghost. You're trying to be black, and the ghost is telling you to be a ghost.
This is Malachi Daniels, talking to you from New York City. You're listening to Aboriginal News, Angry Indian Radio, a place where you can come to hear what's really critical and discussed about African people, about Indigenous people. What is going on globally, where you can come and get real information. This is not CNN. This is not even RT or STV. This is Aboriginal News. Come and get it.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, this is the Angry Indian, and welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We got Brother Maurice Muhammad, Muslim minister. You've heard him before. He's been on the show before. And, you know, it's been pretty heavy. I believe it was the last time he was on, he challenged the National Rifle Association to explain to the black community live, you know, what the hell they were about. In the wake of the Zimmerman trial. And, you know, they didn't take the, you know, they called it bait later on, I heard in the street. You know, they didn't take the challenge. You know, they have a lot to say, but they didn't have a lot to say to him because they know what he's about. They've heard him. And they know that he's the real deal. So, you know, we have him back in here. We're going to talk about yet another case. Another case of wrongful conviction. I mean, it's getting to the point now where I don't even want to hear these stories anymore because it's depressing. You know, because you know what's going on, and we all know people who have been caught up like this. Members of my family have been caught up like this. But, you know, here it is again, you know, another case. And thanks to the internet, you know, thanks to activism, you know, thanks to African people like Brother, you know, Minister Muhammad, who actually are doing something out here, trying to move forward. You know, I mean, yes, a lot of people, you know, they enjoy, you know, the discussions I have with the minister because, you know, he's conservative, I'm not, what have you, right? You know, we're coming from two different angles, but we're together on one thing, and that is strengthening the black family. You know what I'm saying? So, Minister Muhammad, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Oh, thank you, dear brother. It's always a pleasure to be on. Anytime I can get on, this is, I love coming on. I tell you, we have some very good conversations and some very good information that goes out to our people, because we definitely have to change the ties that we're seeing in our community and what we're seeing throughout the world. And the change first starts with us, and then we empower others to make the same changes. Definitely.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
So, you know, today we're going to talk about Brother Jeffrey Wansley. We're talking about a family man who, you know, got caught up in what's supposed to be the war on drugs, but really turns out to be a war on black, brown, and Southeast Asian people. I mean, you know, it is what it is. It is what it is. You know, we've been looking at this since Nixon. You know, this was the build-up. This was the rationale behind SWAT. This was the rationale behind, mass incarceration. I mean, there was even Oliver North, who's been in the news lately because of this Bergdahl scandal here with this prisoner release from Afghanistan. You know, a whole lot of talk about, you know, human rights and whether or not they should have left him, and what's really going on and what have you. And, you know, these same people are the same folks who are really responsible for the climate that put Brother Jeffrey Wansley in the position that he's in. So could you, educate the listeners? And I want to make clear here that, you know, we were trying to actually get Brother Wansley in. You know, we're limited here by our resources, but we do have, probably the best representative we could have for the brother right now, and that's his daughter, Annie Hunter. And we're going to bring her in a little bit. But, Minister, if you could please lay this out for our listeners. You know, we have an international audience. You know, a lot of people are aware, you know, especially our brothers and sisters in the motherland, about mass incarceration, but they don't really understand these individual cases. And in the case of Jeffrey Wansley, you know, we just had Maureen Dowd write a major story that's getting press about her eating some marijuana cookies or something in Colorado where it's legal, and how she flipped out and thought she wasn't going to make it. And everyone's laughing about this. But when it comes to drugs and black people, though, these stories are not funny. So could you please lay this out for me?
Yes, sir. Brother Jeffrey Wansley, this is a case that I've never seen like this before. Normally, you have cases where that actual crime may have taken place or some type of way, that something actually happened and they may have charged the wrong person. But in this case, nothing happened. He was convicted, he was charged and convicted on selling $100 worth of crack cocaine to a guy by the name of Cleveland, I think his name is Cleveland McCall, but that never took place. The police wanted to get his friend, who was an ex-police officer, and they thought that he was selling drugs. So they wanted to use Jeffrey to get his friend. And they talked to Jeff about it, and Jeff told them straight up, no, I'm not going to lie on this man so that y'all can get him. If y'all think he's selling drugs, then y'all go after him and go get him. Y'all should be able to have the evidence. Well, once he took that stand on principle not to go out and make up a story on somebody, they went after him. So they came and picked him up and said that, you know, we want to question you. Did you come downtown? Instead of taking him downtown, they took him over to the ex-police house, officer's house, and watched while they searched his house. And then asked him, well, can we go search your home? He says, sure, go ahead. You can search my home. They searched his home. They didn't find anything. So they take him downtown. He spends some more hours downtown. Then the sheriff come talk to him a little bit and ask him again about lying on trailers. That was the name of the ex-cop. And again, Jeffrey said, no, I won't do that. We have to remember, Jeff had just got out of the Army. He went to serve the country proudly. Coming back, he's believing that there's, you know there's corruption here and there, but not nothing as blatant as what he's about to go through. So when the sheriff says, okay, well, we'll let you go, and walk into the front door, then the Mississippi Bureau of Narcotics came, walked right up to him, and arrested him. And he says, well, what am I being arrested for? He said, for the sale and distribution of crack cocaine. So they took him and didn't give him, he asked for him to get a lawyer. He didn't get a lawyer. They had the whole thing set up with the DA, the judge, and his mom came down there to check to see what was going on. The sheriff said that he had 67 warrants wanting for him in Atlanta. They just made up so much different lies. They kept him in jail. And then one day before his trial, they came and told him, okay, well, now you're about to stand trial on this. They claim that they had Little June is their little CI. They claimed that Little June walked up to Jeff's house, knocked on the door, asked Jeff for the crack. He gave Jeff a $100 bill. Jeff gave him the crack rocks. Mm-hmm. At trial, no evidence was presented. They asked, well, where is the recording? The Mississippi Bureau from Narcotics said that the recording was crystal clear. It was so clear you could hear McCall's footsteps walking. That's how clear that the tape was. But during trial, they didn't have no tape to present. They said that the tape was messed up some kind of way. All of this is in the court records that you can go back and read exactly what I'm saying. So then they claimed that there was a $100 bill that was marked, that was used, and where it came from, where's the evidence of the $100 bill? They couldn't find it. Then, so the crack was not there with Jeff's fingerprints. None of that was there. The money was not there. The audio tape was not there. Nothing. Jeff, several different times, objected. And the judge sent the jury out of the room every time Jeff would object. He even talked about how his lawyer that they gave him was unprepared because he never sat down with Jeff to say, okay, let's go over your case.
He never once consulted with his client?
Never. Not one time. Not one time.
All right, let me bring... Sister Hunter into this, because you know one of the things that gets me about this sister is that I'm looking here at the serial number on the site, and I want our listeners to go check this out, jeffreywansley.com, one word. We're gonna add the site to the page with the dispatch, but I want you to check this out, jeffreywansley.com, and when you go there you'll see the serial number of the official state, paper money, the $100 bill that they allege was used in this transaction, and the number, Wansley's innocence team had this checked with the United States Department of the Treasury, and under a Freedom of Information Act request, the agency verified that the serial numbers came off a $20 bill. So, Sister Hunter, you know, I mean, when you look at this sort of travesty of justice, you know, I mean, to black people in general, but, you know, to your father, what goes through your mind? How has this affected your family?
It affected me greatly on one hand, because at the time that my father was incarcerated, I was staying with him. And he had not been back for about 5 months. And the only thing he did was went to work and took care of us. When he ever had time to sell drugs, I don't know where they fit that in his schedule at, because my dad worked at night. So by the time we came home, and my dad helped us with our homework, you know, make sure we got something to eat. And once dad went to work, you know, my older sisters was there. The house was shut down and locked. And when my dad would come home, he'd make sure we get off to school, and my dad would sleep all day. So when I look at everything, it's a conspiracy, because I feel like in order for them to pull all of this off, I just think about how many people had to conspire to get the job done. The judge, Marcus Thornton, the prosecutor, Stanley Amos, his supposedly court-appointed attorney, Mark Duncan, Deputy Sheriff Sammy Stevens, Sheriff Jackie Knight, Judge Vernon Cotton, all of the jurors, and what's so peculiar about his case is all of the jurors that sat on his case, the exact same jurors had sat on three prior cases. And you're looking... The same exact set of jurors sits on the same three prior cases, civil cases, and now they're on his case. That's impossible. And you're looking at a judge that has a 100% conviction rate. Nobody is perfect. So it affected me greatly, because I knew what type of father that I had, and for my father to be abducted and taken off, and for me to have to go through, to have went through a lot of the things I went through, I blame them. Because I could understand if my dad was actually a drug dealer, if he actually sold drugs. But they say, if you do the crime, you do the time. But you have an innocent man that takes care of his children, an upstanding citizen, served in the military, that's actually doing what he's supposed to do. Why would you take this man off the streets? You have so many people out there that's doing wrong, that's not doing anything to their for their community, not for their children, and you would rather take my dad off the street. And so at the time, I was really young, and I moved not too long after that, and I lost contact with my dad for over 14 years. And just up until recently, I just got in contact with him and a couple of months ago. And during that time, me, him, Maurice, and a couple other groups, including yourself now, have been working diligently to get this case out there to the media to let them know what's going on.
Yeah, and excuse me for not welcoming you properly when we got into this. I apologize for that. But, you know, Brother Muhammad, you were telling me about these three cases that Sister just mentioned as we were warming up a little bit before we came in. You know, could you give our listeners some details on that?
Sure. Now, Marcus Gordon, the judge for this trial, is the same judge who sentenced the Scott sisters for life in prison for supposedly $10. Some of the things that are very similar with the Scott sisters is that the sheriff and the judge had problems with their father and took it out on them. This same judge had a problem with Jeff's father, because Jeff's father beat him back in the 60s over school lunching for black children in Union, Mississippi. So he didn't like Jeff. He didn't like Jeff's father. And so he gets the opportunity for vengeance, and he takes it. This is the same judge who sentenced Keeling, for the trial for the murders in 1964. He's been on the bench for 26 years. This guy is very corrupt. Very, very, very corrupt. But he rules that town out of fear, because he has the ability and the will, and everybody knows that he will do it, sentence you to jail for some real long time, even if you have not done anything. This is the only judge that I have known that has a 100% conviction rate.
Yeah, that's what the sister mentioned. You know, how is that possible?
Exactly.
How is that possible?
Yeah. against, nobody's perfect. And just recently, might I add, just to show you how cruel this judge is, I had an uncle, just recently, just to show you how he rolls. Supposedly, him and the police officer got into a altercation. So they gave him assault on a police officer. They gave him 30 years. Marcus Gordon gave him 30 years. It was told him he had to back up. He was on probation. So he said he had to back up 15, and he gave him 15 more. 30 years for mandatory 30 years for assault on a police officer.
So what is the African community in Mississippi, are they knowledgeable about this case? You know, are there ministers, or are there, you know, is anybody out there talking about this, that the community is aware of what's happening to your father?
Yeah, but they're scared. They're scared of him because let's say if somebody wants to get involved in the case, well, they have sons. He'll threaten their sons. He'll threaten their cousins, their nephews, their uncles. They are terrified of this man. Terrified. This is the same judge. This is the same judge. I remember this is the same judge when I was about 10 or 11. He was a part of the KKK in Philadelphia. And during the in Philadelphia, he got beat pretty bad in Philadelphia. So he had to, he didn't come to work for about 3 or 4 months because that's how serious. When those boys got a hold to a couple of them, he was one of them. And it was going around town. So everybody was waiting on him to show. He didn't come to work for about 4 months. That's how bad he was beaten. He didn't go to a hospital in our county. He went to a hospital in a couple counties over. he didn't even come. He didn't even go to the hospital, but he took about 4 or 5 months off overseas. He's a strong member of the KKK as well in Philadelphia.
It's that basically this man has been walking around with a chip on his shoulder since the Civil Rights era.
Correct. That's right. Basically.
All right. Well, let me ask you, Brother Muhammad, because you know you're an experienced organizer. Has the ACLU and the Innocence Project been made aware of Wansley's case?
Yes, they have. The Innocence Project, because it's not DNA based, they're not going to touch it. The ACLU have not responded to me. I've talked with the NAACP down there. At one time, he said, yeah, we'll come and we'll help out. But it seems, I'm not going to say funny, but you can talk to a person one time, and then when you go back and talk to them the second time, their story changed. And unfortunately for us, when the DA called my cell phone and told me that if we come to Mississippi and start to stir up trouble in that town, that we would go to jail, all of a sudden, things started to change. So people knew that we were coming, and they knew that they have already made that threat to us that we're going to face some real repercussions if we go down there and try to do anything. He also said to me, there will not be a church that will hold any rally for you all when you come here. Let me tell you that now. You will not find any support in this city for anything that you're trying to do. And so, one thing that our people and a lot of other people, but mainly our people, we've suffered a lot. And we have this fear of what repercussions is going to do. But we got to shake off that fear, because that's what keeps them in power. It's not so much what they say or what they try to do, but it's our fear of them that keeps them in power. If we would break off that fear and do what people supposed to do, it will pull them down. Now, why would they call me and threaten me? That lets us know that A, they know that they were wrong. B, they know that the crimes that they committed against Jeff, if it was brought to the front, they would have to go to jail. that whole system of people that operated from the judge to the DA to the sheriff to the Board of Narcotics. I mean, you even have a woman, Sherry Robinson, in the jail system. She herself gave Brother Jeff an enhanced sentence and made him ineligible for parole when that wasn't even her right to do.
What?
But she took it upon herself to add 30 years to his already 30 years, so making him serve 60 years. She did that with the stroke of a pen. With the stroke of a pen.
Now, what sort of sister? What sort of legal defense did your father have when he walked into court?
When he went to, okay, mind you, not a day before a trial, they came to him and told him he has trial the day before trial. So the day of trial, they came to get my father, and he said he wasn't going to trial, that he was not prepared for his case. He has not admit his, he was not allowed an attorney. He has not even admit a court-appointed attorney, so he wasn't going to trial. So the deputies, they left and they came back and they told my father, we were ordered to, if you don't come out of the jail, we are ordered to drag you into court. So my father said, okay. He left and went with the deputies. He went to court. So as he sat down, he's looking at the judge, and then my dad said, can I get an action? Could he get a continuance? First he asked him, can I get a lawyer? He says, why do you want a lawyer? Don't you have a court-appointed attorney? He said, I don't know who my court-appointed attorney is. I'm sitting here in this courtroom today, and I don't even know who my court-appointed attorney is. So his court-appointed attorney finally decides to show up and nods his head and throws his hands up to let my father know, hey, I'm your court-appointed attorney. But at the time, he's coercing with the prosecution. My dad asked for a continuance, and he said, no, you can't get a continuance. He said, well, can I get a fair trial? He said, I'll give you the fair trial that I can give you. He said, how are you giving me a fair trial when you're denying me a continuance? You haven't gave me time to prepare for lawyers. I may have witnesses that I can call. You violated my rights. I haven't received a phone. I haven't gotten a phone call. You violated so many my constitutional rights, so how am I getting a fair trial? And he basically told him, I'll give you the fairest trial I can give you and sit down in my courtroom. And that's exactly how the trial starts.
Okay, we're going to take a brief break here, but when we come back, I'm going to ask Brother Muhammad to really expand on wrongful conviction and how this relates to not just the post-slavery period during Reconstruction, but convict lease. Everybody's talking about the mass incarceration. I think it's mostly right now because it's a hashtag. I don't think they really understand what the hell is going on. And how this type of, inhuman, degrading violation of, people's rights in the U.S., in North America in general. How this relates to the sort of propaganda we're seeing with when you have a number one show called Orange is the New Black.
Exactly.
I think that's the question we all need to ask. This is the Angry Indian. I'm in the studio with Honorable Minister Maurice Muhammad and Sister Annie Hunter, the daughter of Jeffrey Wansley. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stick around.
Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid from The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Howard Zinn. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced false news reports, imprisoned without charge, and tortured, targeted civilians, and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Fred Leonard. It is mind-blowing for us to be here, now, at this late hour, with Leonard Peltier still in chains. Books have been written, documentaries have been produced, congressmen have joined his freedom campaign, all for naught. For Leonard Peltier, a former leader of the American Indian Movement, AIM, is still not free. That, to anyone with a soul, is a damn shame. Many Peltier supporters put their trust in a politician named Bill Clinton, who told them that when he got elected, he wouldn't forget about the Native American leader. Their trust, like those of so many others, was betrayed once Clinton gained the office and the FBI protested. In the waning days of his presidency, he issued pardons to folks like Mark Rich and other wealthy campaign contributors. Leonard Peltier was left in his chains. I won't restate the obvious. Leonard's innocence, the blatantly unfair trial, the crooked tricks that led to his extradition. Others may do that. What is needed is more support, not from two-faced politicians, but from the people, the many, who, like me and you, know injustice when we see it. Join the movement to free Leonard, Gwath Elas, or he who leads the people. Build it, for only a mass movement can bring freedom. Thank you. On the move, long live John Africa. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more, if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian Movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
I lost my son,
my nephew,
my uncle,
my son
on September 11, 2001.
Most people don't know that a third tower fell on September 11.
World Trade Center 7, a 47-story skyscraper, was not hit by a plane.
Although the official explanation is that fire brought down Building 7,
over 1,200 architects and engineers have looked into the evidence
and believe there is more to the story.
Bring justice to my son,
my uncle,
my nephew,
my son.
Go to buildingwhat.org.
Why it fell, why it matters, and what you can do.
Would you like to hear the lie that judges tell jurors every day?
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
In a criminal case, the judge instructs the jury, you decide the facts, but you jurors must apply to those facts the law as I explain it. And if the prosecution has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must return a verdict of guilty. The problem with this instruction? It's not true. It's not true at all. And the judge well knows that, but most jurors don't. Jury nullification, the right of jurors to say no, to just say no to a prosecution, was central to the Bill of Rights. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson famously believed that jurors' right to nullify was central to democracy. Writing in the Champion magazine recently, criminal defense attorney Patrick Barone cautions that care must be taken when considering nullification because juries can use that authority to enhance and augment the power of the elite rather than to limit it. But, Barone continues, jury nullification can and should be a critical limitation on legislatures bent on promulgating and judges bent on enforcing ever more overreaching criminal laws. The take-home lesson here, criminal juries should know of their right to nullify because that power can constitute liberty's last defense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union because freedom can't defend itself.
Hey,
this is Vagabond producer, writer, and director Machetero. You're listening to The Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Another recipe written through telepathy. At all times, keep my secret weapon next to me. Soloist, I can't control the way I flow with this. I'm trying to save life, just like Noah did. What's the truth? Look at all these rotten fruit. All the young youth did it stem from the roots. Shady governments, they sniffing heroin and drop bombs on Lebanon. And it's gonna come. Activists, you gotta master psychiatrics or get the padded mattress. Y'all niggas been deceived. I'm talking about you, the crackheads and the thieves. We need to focus on our needs. We dying every day because we can't sustain greed. Obese police beat niggas in the streets. CEOs, president, they all creeps. Are we certain that these churches working because the hood's hurting? We've been tricked by yourself, nobody's perfect. If you study properly, we all God's property. So many called, but they spread the word sloppily. Then the few, see I'm way beyond your curfew. Sticks and stone, but it's words that really hurt you. You see, it's words that really hurt you.
Till my own, I'm so humble. Dying thirsty from the struggle. Till my own, I'm so humble. Dying thirsty from the struggle. Till my own, I'm so humble. Dying thirsty from the struggle. Till my own, I'm so humble. Dying thirsty.
All right, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is the Angry Indian, and we have the Honorable Minister Maurice Muhammad in the studio, and we're speaking to the daughter of Jeffrey Wansley, another brother out here in the wilderness that is North America, who has been wrongfully convicted. And Sister Annie Hunter is here to represent him this afternoon. And, we're going to go into the history right now of what happened after Reconstruction, because a lot of African people who have been kind of bought off by, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful to anyone, I'm just trying to point out an observation here. You know, we're caught into what Beyonce's doing, but Beyonce's not speaking to this issue or anything like this. She's considered to be the new face of feminism, and I'm not understanding how that works, other than the fact that white feminists consider her to be the new face of feminism. And we get caught up in conversations and discussions and real serious mind whirlpools about subjects like that, or whether or not JC cares about us. Jay-Z doesn't care about us. His presence is charity. He would never speak on a case like this. He hasn't spoken on a case like this. If it wasn't for, the Reverend Sharpton, he and Beyonce would have never had shown up to any of the Trayvon Martin rallies. You know what I mean? You know, they're looking for press ops. You know, they're looking for, propaganda that will propel their careers and propel, basically what they're pushing, which is an assimilationist North America, which we could accept if African people, if Native people, right, if Asian folks. You know, we're actually accepted as human beings. We're able to sit at the table and not have to be somebody else. But that's not the case. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that if Jay-Z, if Beyonce, if an Oprah Winfrey, if a Barack Obama, okay, if a Negro with money and with status, a Colin Powell, any of them decided to speak up on a case like this, see, we would have some action, but we don't. You know, we've had people who talk about this and pay a serious social price, right? The families pay a price, they have to sacrifice. But on the other hand, we have people who could be saying something and don't. And we had to wait, really, and this should be offensive to most African people, whether you consider yourself to be an activist or not. When it takes Noam Chomsky, who is a good activist, but he is not a member of our community. But it takes him to talk about what's happening in the African community. Or I have to look at Russia Today or Press TV from Iran. Russia Today, representing Russia, of course, is the state television service broadcast in English. I have to look at the foreign press, Al Jazeera, to find out what's happening about cases like this in the United States. And there's a history behind this. So, Brother Muhammad, if you could go into that, briefly, so that, our listeners can, really start to connect the dots behind yesterday, what's happening today and what we're going to continue to, you know, foreseeably deal with if we don't put a stop to it right now.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, right after the slaves were freed, well, first we have to understand that the slaves were used for big business to keep going on. So that makes the increase of profits because they don't have to pay labor when you got free labor to do it. So now when your free labor pool is missing, you got to now begin to pay that money to keep your business moving. So your profit is not as great as it was when you had free labor versus paid labor. So what they started to do was, those of us who got arrested, they would be giving out to the plantations so that they can go and work in those fields. And a little side deal maybe was made with the sheriff or whoever was over it. And they started that process and continued that process. They will pick you up off the street, whether you committed a crime or no crime. And next thing you know, you find yourself back in slavery, working on somebody else's field, and you get nothing. As we go to current day here in America, it's the same old thing. You have a lot of people that's being locked up. You have private prisons who have a tapped labor force of workers that may get between $1 or maybe $2 an hour for all the labor that they're going to do. So prisons today is big business. They have a mandatory minimum of being filled at 90% capacity. And some states now are being sued by the prison because the prison may be at 89 or 85% and not at that 90%. So this free labor, because they got outsourcing labor to this country and labor to this country, but the prisons are so packed filled with slaves now that they can go ahead and let them work and still make that big money that they were used to making. So that's why in the Constitution it states that, you know, if you're duly convicted of a crime, then now you can be put back into slavery. Well, in our court system today, we've been guilty, but we have not been given what we would consider to be a fair trial. When you look at cases like Jeffrey Wansley, where a crime never happened, but you made it up and put things in place and then stripped this man of his life and from his family. So now that you can make money off of him as he goes to work and do the things that he has to do while you sit back and make big business. You make big money. It's all about that profit. It's all about that capitalistic system that they must keep alive. And the best way to do that is with free labor. So they don't have to worry about importing fees or exporting fees. They make it right here in America with all these bodies filled up in these private prisons. That's why it's so important for us to really understand and take our time now to fight. A brother, John Gaines, told me a few months back, he said, "Brother Muhammad, you know, I really feel bad that when I heard you talking about other cases and I listened with sympathy, but I didn't get involved. And now I find myself in a position where I need people to help because 8 members of my family was killed by a drunk driver whose uncle, whose grandfather happens to be the former governor of Louisiana, and they're giving this boy life time, 2 years for killing 8 members of my family. Now I need help to fight." So what we gotta understand is, if the bug of injustice hasn't bitten you yet, if it hasn't bitten somebody you know yet, keep living, because it's coming. It's coming. So let us do everything that we can do now to prevent this from happening to somebody else. Because that's what happens. Because we are so comfortable. We are the most comfortable oppressed people on the planet. And because we are so comfortable with what's going on, it goes by and say, "Oh, okay, well, it won't happen to me." But it will. There will be somebody next. because you let it get away when it was that person. So there's going to be somebody next. There was somebody after Trayvon because Zimmerman got away. That's why that man was comfortable enough to kill like that, to shoot like that, because he thought he was going to get away, and he really did.
Yeah.
He really did. Second degree is nothing. But we got to stop that stuff by standing up and saying no more. No more. Whatever you allow them to get away with, they'll continue to do it. Because there's no resistance. No resistance. And we got to change that. That's why I admire Sister Annie for being able to get on the front line. This is a mother. And she knows what she's dealing with. But she don't care. She wants the freedom of her father. Because she knows if they can do him like that, what will they do to her babies? What will they do to her? What will they do to the next person? Don't sit around and we talk about what rights that we should have. We talk about the government and our liberties. Well, we got to understand that the government is instituted among men and women for our inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But those aren't civil rights. That's human rights.
It's on another world. Dear brother, I got Jeff on the phone now. And I'm going to try to see if you can hear him. Jeff, can you introduce yourself? Are you able to pick that up, dear brother?
Please be advised, this transmission has been compromised. Repeat, this transmission has been compromised.
Can you hear me?
Because the devil has a long shadow.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, man, something's going on now. First she got cut off, and then you got cut off. So, trying this again here. Might have to do this whole thing all over again.
Okay.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, but I'm trying to hook up with her now. I can't hear her at all.
Me either.
That's happened before, remember? Hello, sis, are you back?
Hello?
Yeah, hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Hello, sis, are you back?
Yeah, I got disconnected.
Yeah, and I'm starting to wonder now how much we actually got, because it's happened before. Yeah, okay, I don't know what the hell just happened, and I apologize to you, but he's been on the show before, but you haven't. It's happened sometimes when we've had certain discussions about certain subjects,
yes.
Somehow it just got cut.
Yeah, conspiracy. I'm bad.
So, I'm really sorry about that, but it happened with you a couple of times, Muhammad, where we had to, like, restart.
Uh-huh.
Really, so, I really apologize, sister, but, you know, it does happen sometimes.
Okay.
I know I got most of what it was, but just for the hell of it, so that my partner can try to edit some of the stuff.
This is Radio Anglo-Indian. Anglo-Indian Radio for the Fourth World.
Hello, I am Susan Aglukkaq. The North has the highest incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, in the country. We also have a high rate of teenage pregnancies. High-risk behaviors, unprotected sex, lead to the spread of HIV/AIDS. It can be prevented. Learn the ways to protect yourself and others. Knowledge is power.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that prevents pregnancy. It is not an abortion pill and does not cause an abortion, only the prevention of pregnancy. If you have had unprotected sex or have been raped and need Plan B, contact your local Indian Health Service. You have a legal right to receive Plan B over the counter, meaning without a prescription or a doctor's appointment if you are 17 or older. Plan B must be taken within 72 hours of sexual intercourse to be effective. For more information, call 605-487-7072. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying, for Men in Hip Hop. Really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable, you know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It shouldn't be supported, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her, and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
Let me ask a very simple question. Does it concern you that the government is spying on you? 30 years ago, to even ask this question would have been a scandal. If you lived through Watergate, if you read the Church Committee reports, you know the costs of unchecked government surveillance. The government is exploiting our amnesia. We did not pass the Fourth Amendment in order to protect those with something to hide. We passed that amendment, which prohibits general warrants or limitless surveillance, because we know all too well the cost of an unaccountable government. The question is not, do you have something to hide? The question is whether we control government or the government controls us. Remember, this struggle is part of who we are as a people. This country was born in rebellion because the British government was exerting too much control over American lives. We broke free and began to create a system of government meant to protect liberty. Our national history reveals a constant struggle to stay true to this value. We face one of those moments of struggle right now. Recent leaks have given us a glimpse into our government's gigantic surveillance machine. It's a machine that is eating our freedom. If this concerns you, and it should, you need to contact your representatives in Congress now. Ask them to end the tracking of Americans' domestic communications. I won't stand idly by while our civil liberties are eaten by the NSA's surveillance machine. You shouldn't either.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
Go on, chillin. That's what we're talking about. We need a little help. Can't do this y'all alone. Thank God for this. Lick. James Brown, y'all. Yes, this your evening. One more time. We're the act on the chillin' for get up. Get into it. Get involved. Oh, Hunter Children, when I have to come down here to the Gullah Geechee Nation, and so glad that Hunter to tune in to we Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio Station. Hunter Children, no, this year the head from the body of this year nation and the heart of we station. Queen Quest, come on, Children, get involved. Get involved. Get involved to the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition, the sponsor of this year radio station. Hunter Children, this year the we show, Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio. Come on, y'all.
Let it do it. White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And the Democrats are throwing the election away. For what? An inadequate black male? Who would not have been running had it not been a white woman that was running for president. I'm no second-class citizen. And God damn the Democrats.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
A moment before 2 o'clock with a caller who actually, I think, in a very important way gave us a direct pivot into this conversation, because I think most important alongside of the psychology of self-hatred that happens with us as a people is that you mentioned it among global African people.
Yes. Yes. Because, of course, we're dealing with a global power, the global European power, and a global economy which is under the influence of course, under the control of Europeans and works to the benefit of Europeans. And it's in the context of that global economic power and the attendant military and other powers that the African personality is shaped. Mm. So hardly any African group, any significant African group, escapes that shaping process.
There are those from the Caribbean, as in the caller, and I wanted to maybe have us talk about this, who feel that perhaps maybe people from the Caribbean, for example, because of what is projected here as a strong work ethic coming in from out of the country, working, setting up businesses, that it may be significantly different there.
But we see the same game being played. As we talk further in this segment, we will see that all classes of black people are servants to Europeans. And whether you're middle class, upper class, if there is one, a lower class, you're from the continent or from the Caribbean, from the American system here, the basic role is the same. Mm. But within that role are different levels and different degrees and different characters. The white system does not produce one black character. It produces a set of characters.
For example?
And it produces characters that serve different functions. And those characters will have some relationship to their geographical background, historical experience, and to other kinds of things that go on in the world.
You said the system creates characters, don't you?
Oh, yes.
What do you mean? Give me an example of what you mean.
It will create, if it needs, for instance, a certain number of blacks to indicate to the world that it is liberal, it will create a small middle class that gives it the image of being a liberal country. For instance, I'm talking about the United States now.
Okay.
And these people then will be used to try to deceive other black people into thinking that their lack of achievement is a result of some individual deficiency in their personality.
Mm-hmm.
It often so needs a group that sees to its interests among the oppressed masses, and it often then must create a class such as the neo-colonial class, the ruling governmental classes, to see to its interests while creating the impression again that these people are free and independent. So it will even create criminals to justify repression. So it has a role for almost any segment of our community. And all of these roles, in one way or the other, justifies its existence, you see.
Do you, in the context that you are presenting this particular reality, see this as a very deliberate process that is taking place?
Oh, very much so. It has to be deliberate because it is necessary to maintain the economic social system.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it is thought out and worked through very deliberately.
This would say, in other words, then, that we might reach a point, let's say, where things get so bad that you're saying that those individuals who are in these positions that we're talking about say, well, wait a minute, this is getting a little too bad.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to open up a segment and create this to calm that down.
Yes. And this happens quite frequently. We saw it happen during the 60s, 70s. I often use that phrase that you hear all the time about things change to remain the same. So often you create apparent change to keep situations the same. Mm-hmm. The European learned, of course, that they did not have to maintain a direct military presence, say, on the African continent or in other areas where Africans live, in order to protect their political and economic interests. So you create then a ruling class, an indigenous ruling class there, you see, and there appears to be change, and it is a change of a sort. However, the basic economic dominance does not change at all. You see, I often talk about what I call the constants, you see, in our relationships with Europeans. And it's important that we look at the constants, not the superficial changes, you see.
Interesting.
And often what happens is that first the European makes superficial the African intellect and makes superficial the African intelligence so that the African can be deceived by superficial changes while the basic and fundamental relationships are not changed at all. Down at the Institute of Technology, I was talking to my students the other day, and I told them that, you know, now you are electrical engineers, but your fundamental relationship between your fundamental relationship to whites is no different from your grandparents who were in slavery, because that fundamental relationship is one of producing profits for your European masters. And so if at some point making blacks engineers, or letting them be engineers, or letting them be computer technologists, or even letting them be president of the United States will maintain that constant relationship, that change will occur. And so often people then will respond to that apparent change and miss the fact that the fundamental relationships have not changed at all.
You mentioned in the context of these constants, it is, and we mentioned this a bit earlier in the first hour, and I mentioned it to you when we were in the break, the one thing that does seem to absolutely be constant and consistent in whatever discussions we have, whether they be about politics, economics, culture, family, whatever, is this issue of learning to love ourselves versus self-hatred. How does the system go about creating or perpetuating this pattern of self-hatred?
Self-hatred is necessary for the system. I want to leave this segment off by indicating something I say quite often, that in order for this system to maintain itself, it is a political necessity for black people to be out of their minds. And I follow, I follow this up with the refrain that I am not being rhetorical. I mean that literally. We have to be out of our minds. We cannot be within our basic natural personality. When you have a minority group of people that exploits a vast majority group of people the way our people are exploited along with other people, and those people are exploited without direct being directly put under the gun, or that being directly put into concentration camps, when those people are exploited by just going about what they see as their daily way of living, those people can only be exploited by being out of their minds, by being off center, off base. And I try to indicate then one of the fundamental things about a black psychology and African psychology in the context of today's world is that the African psychology must begin from the fundamental assertion that it is a political necessity for black people to be out of their mind. It is a political necessity for black people to be dumb. And that does not excuse even blacks with PhDs and well-educated. And I'll explain that in greater detail later on, you see, as we go along, how dumbness becomes endemic through all class levels of the black community, and how even education itself is an education into dumbness.
It is very interesting that you are saying it. I recall that in Richard Pryor's, I guess, peak of success, when he released an album called That Nick Is Crazy. The interesting thing about it was, is when one listened to the content of the things that he was pointing out some very serious things
Definitely.
That were part of living in this society.
Definitely.
But he was saying something in that concept, which was that you did have to operate from the mentality of being crazy
yes.
to actually function
yes.
in this space that they had put you in.
You could not, the world could not be other than it is unless this were the case.
Mm.
You see? So self-hatred is the central keystone of the whole edifice.
Interesting.
And almost any behavior that you see our people engaged in that maintains us under the domination of the European is in some way related to self-hatred. And there are a number of methods that are used to produce this state of mind, or what we call self-negation.
We'll come back and we'll pick up on that point. And we'll do that right after these words. At 1190 WLIB, I see some of you already have decided that it's time to talk to Dr. Amos Wilson, and I can appreciate that.
Things African must somehow be degraded. And even in the name of progress, among us, often progress is brought at the price of course, denaturing ourselves,
mm-hmm.
deculturizing
mm-hmm.
ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
In making it in the system, we have to turn loose
yeah.
the culture. You know, I say in my forthcoming book that the African cannot be a slave and an African at the same time. And we cannot be servants of another people and Africans at the same time either, you see. And so, nobody...
Wait a minute, we better repeat that. Because I heard something there.
Mm-hmm.
Say that again.
That we cannot be servants and Africans at the same time. You see, to be faithful servants to these people requires that we give up our African culture and heritage to a great extent, vastly transform it. And of course, you see this in graphic terms in the slave camp. You're not going to hold your original language or your religion or cultural values or social organization and relationships. And you see in the slave camp, all of these things are ultimately wiped out or at least severely
mm-hmm.
Reduced. Now, of course, you have today those of us who are getting educated, but we get educated at the price, of course, of learning to speak like the other people, to
mm-hmm.
think like them, dress like them, and the whole bit. So again, and that is the price for movement, often for what we call social mobility.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, we often then have to lose vital parts of ourselves and culture in order to move or be mobile in the system itself, which implies often that those characteristics are not worthy of keeping.
You know, it's interesting that you're saying this. I had a chance to look last night at a trade magazine, a music trade,
mm-hmm.
which had a picture of a very popular recording artist who is an African-American recording artist. And he was performing, I believe, in Ireland
mm-hmm.
or someplace. And wherever he performed, they had on the little dress, you know, the dress that they have from their culture.
Right.
And what was interesting was it occurred to me in seeing this, and the people who had this on were like the record executives from the area.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a real thing. They were greeting him in their ethnic
yeah.
apparel.
Yes. Yes.
And I thought to myself, the same shot
mm-hmm.
in Africa with something very, very ethnic.
Yes.
Would produce another kind of reaction.
A completely different impression. Often in the process of doing business, as I go downtown, I get immediate reactions when I wear my African cap. You know, it's a whole different thing there. And so I could almost manipulate the behavior of the people I deal with by the way I dress. And if I put on my cap, I get quite a few negative reactions or fear
right.
reactions
right.
or other kinds of reactions, and it changes the nature of the business that I'm doing often with people.
Oh, my hat.
Yes, very much so. And
I've seen it, boy, but it's
yeah,
deep.
And of course, as I could, if I dress as a European, I have no problem. In fact, it smooths relations of whatever type. Even in terms of teaching in my previous institutions, if I came in dressed in African garb, It was read by many people as some form of rebellion or other. If I came in wearing, of course, European dress, it would indicate, of course, what is it, my ambitiousness, my desire to achieve, or something else of that nature.
But now there are those who might be in listening say, well, okay, is that fair? What happens if someone from another particular area of the world, any European area, came in their native dress to the college or the campus? Maybe there might be the same reaction. How do you respond?
If some Europeans came in their native...
To lecture or whatever, you know.
Well, that's seen as par for the course. And as quite appropriate and in tune.
In other words, you were attempting to take them into a deeper meaning of your presentation or whatever. Yeah.
Because, of course, we read code. We read images that are given off by clothes. And this is particularly true of African Americans.
Hmm.
Because often it has been used to symbolize rebellion on our parts or symbolize non-acceptance of standard values and approaches, which is extremely anxiety-provoking for whites, you see. Hmm. Because their system, as I indicated earlier, of course, it relies upon our acceptance of it and seeking to be a part of it. And when you signal that you may not be this way, and that you may be, and there may be others out there like you who are not this way, then there's that system which depends on us being in a certain way is threatened. And you get a fear reaction and a defensive reaction, you see, and quite often an offensive one, because it's an attempt to put back in place what is getting out of place. Of course, this is part of the old thing about keeping one in his place.
You are.
Because there is a certain place that we must be kept in order for the system to be kept.
And this goes back to your statement, we cannot be servants or slaves and Africans at the same time.
You cannot. No.
Amazing.
That's why the system must denature you in various sorts of ways.
And certainly deculturize you.
Deculturize you, certainly. Yeah. And in the name of a lot of things. You know, the name of education or the name of...
professionalism.
Joining the mainstream or whatever. But that's the essence of power anyway.
Yeah.
You see, that the group in power is in a position to demand certain behavioral characteristics and certain dress codes and the whole bit.
And it's certainly one of those things, of course, is to demand the idea that those people who are in the oppressed position actually hate themselves. And certainly power is being built on that in this case. We will break for a minute. I know Pat Atwell is standing by, probably with both ears very keenly placed to what we're talking about this afternoon. I know that. And we'll come back and talk with Dr. Amos Wilson. And you, those of you who have joined us already, standing by. We'll come back and we'll move to your telephone calls for Dr. Amos Wilson and the psychology of self-hatred among global African people. When we return after this at 1190 WLIB.
Our ultimate truths and how we oftentimes don't get at the ultimate truths when we discuss things, especially a question like this. And if I'm wrong, you can tell me. But I, from the history that I've learned and from what I can deduce from it, this the whole thing really got started from the whole idea of the first Bible, not the first Bible, but the versions of the Bible where you have the Genesis and the curses and all of that, and with the Nicene Council, and coming from down from there, with the papal bull, Pope Martin the Fifth and Bishop Las Colas.
Yes.
See, that really, put a stamp on all of it.
Let's get a response, perhaps, from Professor Wilson.
Definitely, the Bible, as it has been used in many instances, has been used to justify many things, and certainly it has been used to justify the enslavement and servitude of black people. Because one of the things you want to do in order to justify yourself if you're a ruler, and also to even justify to the servant his own position, is a source of authority, or a source that is held as an authority by both groups. And since often, at least for the Europeans, the Bible is seen, at least some, as a source of authority and truth, and at the same time by Africans who been held in captivity as such. When one invokes it to justify servitude, it has a very powerful and persuasive effect on both groups and helps to justify it. I don't know whether the Bible was used as the beginning of it, because slavery, of course, has a very long history, even older than the Bible. But certainly the Bible has been a major part, has been used by our enslavers to justify our enslavement.
Professor Wilson, would you comment on something that does come up from time to time, this issue related to religion again? There has been, obviously, a question raised by a number of people, nationalists and otherwise, mm-hmm. of what the effect is of the worship of a Caucasian Jesus Christ figure in the church, which should be mentioned operates against the backdrop of a black Madonna.
Certainly.
Within the same religion that it actually is practiced in.
Certainly. But the thing that we have to recognize very clearly is that in a racist society, or in a society where people are held in oppression, every institution in that society is essentially going to have the same goal in mind, that is to maintain the status quo. Mm-hmm. No institution escapes from that. And this is the thing that we have to keep in mind. Religion is an institution of this system. Education is an institution. The family structure is an institution. The justice system is an institution. The economic system is an institution. And each one of those institutions are not there to work against the interests of the people who are in control of them. So it should come as no surprise to anyone that religion will serve the intentions of the people who are in control of it and in control of its interpretation. We should not expect religion to be an exception to the rule. And I often tell, you know, people, and I try to get across the idea, you see, we have to recognize very clearly that it is through the institutions constructed by a society that society actually creates the personalities and the people and structures the society so that it may maintain its existence. And it is not going to permit an institution to exist that works against its existence. For religion ultimately to exist in many states, it has to become an arm of the state. It cannot, when it is seen as being against state interests, you will see the religious persons being persecuted and destroyed. The Romans stopped persecuting the Christians to a good extent because it ultimately makes Christianity a part of the Roman state. Mm. And it functions to serve the state. This is why we have to recognize, when we look at institutions of any kind, that includes the family institution as well. The institution upon which families are based, which we'll talk about in some following program about love, that's supposedly the basis for marriage. We will see, when you look at those institutions in relationship to oppressed people, they will always work in opposition to their names, to their titles, okay? Such that we're going to talk about the reversal, how black people must be made backwards. We have to be backwards. And our personalities have to be reversed to maintain the system. And it is the institutions that reverse the personality.
What do you mean by the institutions in this case?
Blacks have to be made dumb by education. Okay. They have to go to school to learn to be dumb. All right? We have to learn the economic system in order to be what? Poor. All right? We have to go to the justice system in order to be criminalized. And so you will see we are hooked into the European marriage system to have what? Broken families. And you study each one of them, and you look at the religious system to fall under the control of these other people, be victimized. I often say the churches will take us to hell. Mm. Because often the ministers and other people who are in them, because of the way they're structured and because of their own miseducation in guiding the people, misguide the people. They have love for them. They have great intentions for them. But with wrong knowledge, If they're struggling with their own self-hatred, you're not going to be filled with self-hatred and distorted, have a distorted mind and guide people properly, no matter how much you love them and how great your intentions are. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when you build churches based on it, he mentioned the conferences, the Nicene conference, where we know that the Bible was sort of put together. And when you look at schools of theology that interpret the Bible within the context of the European power structure, and you have ministers then who move forward under that theology, despite their love, often they, and despite their intention to get the people into heaven, they will often misguide them into hell. Mm. They would have to, given this system, because you see, religion in its true sense is an extremely rebellious situation. Because first of all, the truly religious person is not a person who falls under the authority of other individuals. Mm-hmm. One loves God above all else, so that all else has no power. You see? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But when you love men, when you love the acceptance of men, the approval of men, status and position, and you need men to love you and all of this kind of stuff, these people are your gods. Mm. And you worship them before anything, and therefore you fall under their power. You see? And therefore the truly religious person who loves God better than life cannot be coerced in any kind of behavior, even at the threat of his death. Mm. And therefore, you have very few really religious people in the world today, you know.
WLIB, Professor Amos Wilson is our guest, and you're on the air with him at WLIB.
Yes, my brothers, I respect both of you.
Thank you.
All right, and I'm sitting here and I'm taking all this in, and at the same time, I can't help but to think about what happened in Brooklyn with the telephone company, because I feel it's a sabotage thing, and I'll get into that in a little later. And concerning our sense of self-hatred, because I feel it's a retaliation against our boycotting the system, you know, and what better way strategically would be to knock out a phone company, and this way everything else seems to be helpless for the moment. A lot of confusion, you know, and I feel there are some solutions to counter self-hate, and with me, right now, they're more or less geared towards physical releasement, as far as working out and just training hard, just to keep alert and keep my mind clear and supplement with prayer, you know, because I'm not just going to sit here and pray and don't be able to back anything or protect my life or my loved ones, you know. And last part, Brother Gary, is remember, the white man has a God complex, because we need to dwell into that and we can understand who we are and where we're really coming from, because we're bombarded with the psychic garbage every day with soap operas and everything else. And then you look at this series America, and that deeply, to me, analyzes the whole situation. I don't see we need to go any further with that, but I do appreciate that this brother is here bringing this out in the light.
Thank you very much for the call.
He mentions the God complex. Of course, making Jesus white in image is a part of the creation of a God complex. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, one of the fundamental ways we think as human beings is through what we call associative thinking, associating one thing with another. And, of course, the nationalists and others who've spoken to this issue about Jesus being white are speaking in part to the painting of this image to take advantage of this associative tendency that we have as people. The idea being Jesus being a white man as presented by those pictures, mm-hmm. Then ultimately means that the divinity of his whiteness is in some way transferred to people with a white skin. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in praying to this white Jesus, one embeds this whole image of whiteness as somehow higher than into the mind itself.
Does this perpetuate within this dimension of self-hatred that we're talking about?
Very much so. Right. It creates a very deliberate inferiority complex. And, of course, when you couple that with all of the images that we get on TV and radio, and with the reality, too, of whites being in control, it's not too far distant then to reach the conclusion that these people are in their position because implied in terms of this curse and so forth. It's not difficult for many people, consciously or at least unconsciously, to get the idea that white and divinity go together. And you see this kind of thing. And we'll talk about this more as we talk about the psychology of self-hatred. Because it's easy when you look around the world and you see black people suffering everywhere you look, and you see whites in relatively better shape, for some people to reach the conclusion that we are cursed. You see?
Exactly.
And exactly. This leads to tremendous problems.
Indeed.
In personality.
1190 is WLIB Radio in the Key of Life. My guest is Professor Amos Wilson. Our topic this afternoon is the psychology of self-hatred among global African people. We'll come back with more of your telephone calls for our guest right after these words.
To fall for that image. You know, I've talked with people who look at our condition, as I talked about earlier, and you mentioned Garvey, for instance. You see in his work,
right,
he has this realization, you know, everywhere I go, I see the black man at the bottom of the social economic ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us are intrigued by this thing. Why is it that everywhere we go, no matter what, even in countries we call our own, we find other ethnic groups and other people often in control of the real economy and other things in the country. Now, when you make that observation, and then you've been cheated of a knowledge of history, such that you may not know of any period of time during which blacks were not in that position.
Mm-hmm.
You then may reach the conclusion that, well, we've always been in that position, you see. Mm-hmm. And there's a logic then that begins to develop. And I've heard people then who, not being knowledgeable of black history, African history, and looking at our current circumstances, then ask them the question, then what happened to us such that we are in the position that we're in today, and such that we, as far as I can read, which isn't very far, because you see, too, the ruling group has controlled the reading, you see. We've always been in this position.
Hmm.
And then some individual reach the conclusion then that we must be in this position as a result of having done something wrong as a people some time ago. And of course, up comes the whole mythology of Ham, and the only book often that blacks are really permitted to read to any degree that appears to supply an answer.
The Bible, in other words.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're the servant of men, which is what you see yourself in today, as a result of the fact that you did this and such and so, and therefore you are cursed to be in this role. And consequently, then, you have people who now fall under the psychological weight of this kind of mythology. They will not read often a book like Chancellor Williams that will give them a much more realistic reason as to why we are in the position we are today.
It's interesting. I mean, it gets into as you think, so shall you be. Indeed.
Oh, WLIB. Definitely.
You're in the air right now with Professor Amos Wilson. Go right ahead, please.
Yes, hello.
Good afternoon.
Yes, hi. You know, it's coincidental that I just started reading Dr. Wilson's book today.
Thank you.
And I turned the radio on, you know, coming out of school, and I heard it on.
Great.
Because I'm doing a course in educational, you know, psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were studying Skinner's stimulus response theories, which I had a lot of problems with.
A question for our guests very quickly, if you can, too.
You know, how can you reconcile, you know, Skinner's, you know, stimulus response, you know, theories, mm-hmm. you know, with, you know, the self-hatred?
Okay.
We have just a few seconds before news.
Oh, I see. Okay, because I'd like to pursue
Why don't we hold in, and we'll ask this caller to stand by. We'll take a break. This was the first phase of his campaign to reorient the minds of his people. Now, he appealed to all Negro, quote-unquote, newspaper publishers and owners to stop carrying skin-bleaching and hair-straightening advertisements, as they tended to make our people feel that to be somebody, they must try to look like white people. These businessmen became angry with him. They were well paid for pictorial advertisements. Subscriptions cannot, quote, carry a newspaper, and they had no intention to run a paper on sentiment. As the thoughts in the slogan, again, quote, Negro, be yourself, gained more adherence, the tone of the advertisements was changed. So in every phase of life that subjugated their true self, he attacked it. Said he, take down the pictures of white women from your walls and elevate your own women to that place of honor. They are, for the most part, the burden bearers of the race. And mothers, give your children dolls that look like them to play with and cuddle. They will learn as they grow older to love and care for their own children and not neglect them. Men and women, he continued, God made us as his perfect creation. He made no mistake when he made us black with kinky hair. It was divine purpose for us to live in our natural habitat, the tropical zones of the earth. Forget the white man's banter that he made us in the night and forgot to paint us white. That we were brought here against our will is just a natural process of the strong enslaving the weak. We have outgrown slavery, but our minds are still enslaved to the thinking of the master race. Now, take these kinks out of your mind instead of out of your hair. You are capable of all that is common to men of other races. So let us start now to build big business, commerce, industry, and eventually a nation of our own to protect us wherever we choose to live. A beggar race can never be respected. Stop begging for jobs and create your own. Look around you, and wherever you see the need for factories and business, supply it. Stop begging for a chance. Make it yourself, and remember that God helps those who help themselves. Said a Southern woman after she had joined the organization, Garvey is giving my people backbones where they had wishbones. No man had spoken to them like this before. Wherever he went, he stirred something in them so that they could never be the same self-satisfied or happy-go-lucky human beings again. Preachers had told them about the sweet by and by, but he was telling them about the now and now. The good book says that, quote, your just reward shall be in heaven on that great day. But Garvey said, work for it right here and get it here or take it, and then the spiritual reward shall surely come. The words of Marcus Garvey, 1190 WLIV. They ring true today during African History Month, 1987. It's 10 minutes after the hour, 3 o'clock. You're inside of the GBE. I'm Gary Burr. We'll come back with our guest, Professor Amos Wilson, and the psychology of self-hatred among global African people. Our topic is the psychology of self-hatred among global African people. Our guest, Professor Amos Wilson, professor of psychology at the New York Institute of Technology and also at the College of New Rochelle. He's also author of the book, The Developmental Psychology of the Black Child. Professor Wilson, we had a guest who, or rather a caller just a few moments ago, who raised an area with Skinner, I do believe.
A very, very important area, because the topic of what we call Skinnerian conditioning, or instrumental conditioning, is a standard topic raised in psychology. The essence of Skinnerian conditioning, or sometimes SR psychology, particularly of Skinner's type, named after B.F. Skinner, Harvard professor, who didn't so much discover new principles as just codify ways of behaving and consequences that already existed. The essence of it is that behavior is controlled by its consequences.
Okay.
That behavior that brings good consequences tends to be repeated and increased in frequency and probability of occurrence. Behavior that's followed by negative consequences tend to be decreased or eliminated. And a very simple but very powerful principle, and that's really the essence of it. And conditioning involves, to a good extent, you see, manipulating reward and punishment in order to bring about particular changes in behavior, you see. And so it's a very, very important psychology that many black students are educated in and don't understand at all.
What's the twist on it in terms of self-hatred?
The twist is the essence of power. You see, at first, this psychology is often presented in terms of a rat. Okay, you put a rat in a box or in some condition, and if it behaves in a certain way, you give it something to eat, you give it something to drink. Okay, that's a reward. If it behaves in a way you don't want it to behave, you give it an electric shock or punish it or don't give it food. So, of course, because it wants to eat, and of course you make sure you've starved it before you put it in. mm-hmm. the system. So if it wants to eat and so forth, it eventually learns the relationship between certain behavior and certain consequences. So if by standing up on its two hind feet it gets fed, it will stand up on its two hind feet much more frequently than before the system was put into order, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So the rat is conditioned by living under those circumstances. The experimenter who has control of the rat, you see, can create certain behaviors or reinforce certain behaviors in the rat by determining which behaviors will be rewarded and which will be punished.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where black students are miseducated in these psychology classes is that often the lesson is left right there. Okay. And I use this experiment, as a matter of fact, to get people to understand the difference between equal education and a relevant education, of how a black student can be equally educated with a white student. They just learn the same thing and be made dumb by the same learning. Now, a black student and a white student can learn that principle in the same way, but it doesn't have the same effects. Because you can look at this relationship between the experimenter and this rat as a power relationship, as a political relationship, you see, which says this experimenter, who has control of the rewards and punishments of this rat, is able to create behavior in this rat as a result of having that power. You see, being that he has control over the rewards and punishment, he uses that control to condition the rat. And then when I move on from there, I ask my students then, who has control of the water that comes into your neighborhood? Who has control of the food, the control of the jobs, controls of the symbols of status, control of information? And we go on and on. Can't you see that you are the rat?
Mm-hmm.
You see, this is where you end when you're talking to black students. You don't end with the rat and the experimenter.
Right.
You see, and a black student who has not been taught that, and who has not been taken to have that experiment moved out of its standard presentation into politics and into the reality of his life, is miseducated, even though he's learning the same thing that the white student learned, you see. And this is why I try to get across to the people. You must understand, having our people learn the same thing a white student learned is not going to get you out of your condition. If you look up on the Harlems, the Bed-Stuys, even whole nations where blacks live in the world today, they are boxes. And we are rats in them. And when you see the IMF and the United States banks and the other European countries manipulating reward and punishment, selling weapons and creating wars and doing all of these kinds of things, you have in principle the same thing, you see. And just as that rat's behavior is being created by the manipulation of reward and punishment, the behavior and attitudes of black people are being created by the control of European of rewards and punishment. This is the essence of power. The essence of power is the ability to selectively reward and punish what you want. Now, how does this relate to self-hatred? I hate to hold your people up, but I just want to, because this is a vital topic in psychology, and black students should deal with this topic very thoroughly because they have deep implication. When this is talked about, often the black student identifies himself with the experimenter, and the experimenter is a white man. And it's when you identify with him because he's a human being and the other thing is a rat. But when you identify with that experimenter, you're misidentifying yourself. You see, when the white student identifies himself with the experimenter, his identity is closer to reality, you see. And so in learning the same thing, his racial position is reinforced, even though it appears that he's getting the same education, you see. And people must learn the difference between so-called equal education. Getting equal education for black students is not getting them to learn the same thing white students are learning. And we're going to have to understand this. So then just as that conditioning situation presented by Skinner is what we call a rat in the box, the nations where our people's lives are controlled through the manipulation of Europeans is what we can call a nigger box. Mm-hmm. It is where Africans are created into niggers as a result of the manipulation of reward and punishment by Europeans. We have to keep that in mind. How do you create self-hatred then? a certain of that rat's behavior is associated with reward, with pleasure, with good feelings, with security, with love, if you want to call it that, you see. Mm-hmm. So whenever he performs that, he moves toward that behavior, and he emits that behavior because it brings those rewards. Or he emits that behavior because it helps him to escape from pain, from hunger, from fear, from insecurity, you see. Mm-hmm. And that's another method used in these Skinner boxes, you see, of where if we don't reward the animal, we permit him to escape pain. Okay, now then, listen. All right, now, just one other thing.
I saw echoes of slavery in my mind. I know.
Definitely.
Yeah,
no and, we, and this is going to go back now to drug behavior and everything else that we'll get to, you know, later on. Now, self-hatred, and this goes back to the first statement I made as one of the first methods that's used to breed self-hatred. Remember, the association of innate and personal and group characteristics with negative feelings and so forth. So then, how do you create self-hatred? You make everything that you innately are negative and painful. So that being black is made to be painful. Being African is made to be painful, you see. Identifying yourself as an African is means you don't get rewarded. It means you go hungry. It means you don't get accepted, you see. Yeah. And so by stacking all of these negatives onto African characteristics, it motivates the African to escape his characteristics and seek relief through that escape.
There's something that came up that is just such a graphic illustration of what you're saying in an advertising campaign that never made Madison Avenue. A friend of mine was involved in this, and I don't know what the final rejection was based on, but this was in the 60s, and it was for an aspirin, and it said it was going to be positioned in the subways as, this is what you need for the black ache.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I mean, it was like, you know, when the whole deal and the whole experience of being black is just too much. Take this for the black ache.
And believe me, we move toward pain relievers, which is, of course, why you look at the drugs, and these fundamentally are pain relievers. Mm-hmm. But let's not only talk about drugs. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk later on about sexual addictions, love, what we call love in our community, and other kinds of behaviors that are relievers of pain. One other statement, because the caller admitted something very, very, very rich and fundamental. This self-hatred also is related to this Skinner paradigm. You see, this is how you take knowledge in books and you Africanize it by seeing how it applies and can be used to your own interest.
Yes, yes.
You see,
yes.
And so, but I'll speak about that later. I just want to.
But let's get to the calls. One more.
Because this relates.
These people are going to kill me now.
Yes, go ahead. But this relates to the second principle I wanted to mention that produces self-hatred, and that is to actually create the negative characteristics in the individual group via what I call the self-fulfilling vicious cycle, created incompetences and the creation of subcultures. But through the use of this Skinnerian conditioning, create the actual characteristics that you will come to hate later on, and that the individual will come to hate in and of himself. Mm-hmm. In other words, the black man, as we see him today, is a created person.
Okay.
And he's
an environmentally created person.
Yes, he is conditioned. Mm-hmm. You see, one of the reasons why you want to remove European power is that you want by removing that power, you also remove his ability to create you. Mm-hmm. And by gaining that power yourself, you move into the ability to be self-creating.
WLIB, I'm Gary Bird. You're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon,
Mr. Bird, and to the professor.
Good afternoon.
My question is, which have always puzzled me, concerning the Bible. I would like to ask him a question, and then if he can answer it, hang up and listen.
Okay. Yes.
My question is that when in the Bible concerning Cain and Abel, I would like to know why was it that God, it says that God accepted that Abel offered a sacrifice of a slaughtered sheep or whatever. I would like for him to explain that as possible, because I'm really puzzled by it, and I would like to find out, you know, a little bit more if there any kind of psychological, you know, setting behind that statement that is written in the Bible.
I think the last part gives us a better hook, right?
Yes, because I definitely have to be honest with you and deal with the first segment of that question.
Yes.
Which certainly would have to be referred to religious scholars and people
yes.
who've studied this kind of information. And, of course, I just have to be very general even about the second
yes.
portion of it, because I haven't worked at that in detail at all. Except to say, apparently, it depends on how you see this Bible being written. I mean, if you see it as the Word of God, that's a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you see it, though, as being written by people, as many books are written, to justify certain social systems and political systems,
mm-hmm.
then at least I would take a guess that it's written in this way to perhaps justify the sacrifice as a way of giving praise to God.
I Don't Know More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our Earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Become idle no more.
This is DJ Fusion of the Fusebox Radio Broadcast and BlackRadiosBack.com. You're now listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, another slice of real black radio for the masses. All right, peace.
Que pueda pararnos la revolución. Lucha, compañero, con tu corazón.
Vamos, vamos.